We want to draw in some questions right now, and we've got about 15 minutes to be able to get some questions over to you and points back. What I wanted to do, though, if I may, is start with a question on behalf of one of the young members of the Common Futures Conversation, a network actually which Chatham House has helped convene with the support of the Robert Bosch Foundation and a number of other organizations that brings young Europeans and young Africans together to think about their common future. And Olelakan Ojumu from Nigeria wanted me to pose the following question to you. So if I could kick off with this one. And his question goes as follows. Africa has a security challenge which needs both internal and external support. NATO has already established a working relationship with the African Union. What role will NATO play in curbing the insecurity that has been plaguing the continent beyond 2021? Could you share any thoughts on that specific question first, please, sir?
For NATO, it is extremely important to work with partners in our neighborhood. And Africa is a neighbor of the North Atlantic region where NATO operates. NATO is and will remain a regional alliance for North America and Europe. But of course, what happens in Africa matters for our security. So therefore, we strongly believe in the importance of working with partners, countries, but also organizations like the African Union. And as you just alluded to, NATO has already established a cooperation with the African Union. We also work with the UN. So we help, for instance, with training of peacekeeping forces, capacity building, how to deal with things like improvised explosive devices, how to protect peacekeeping troops in their missions and operations, including in Africa. Then we also have some partner nations through something we call the Mediterranean Dialogue. We work with countries like Tunisia, Morocco, other partners in Northern Africa. I also recently met the president of Mauritania. We are, of course, concerned about the situation in the Sahel region. And NATO allies are helping, supporting to fight international terrorism, different terrorist groups in the region. And we in NATO are also looking into how we can step up and do more, both when it comes to exercises, capacity building, and training. So in NATO, we often say that when our neighbors are stable, we are more secure. So I think it is extremely important that we work with Africa, with African Union, with countries in Africa, and in particular our partners, to support, to help the efforts to fight instability and to fight international terrorism, and work in other ways with African countries.
Thank you very much. And I think with your commentary about the cascading effects of climate insecurity, we could easily see the relationship with African countries and that focus growing. I'm just going to turn to a couple of questions that I see here. We've got a huge amount coming in already, as we might imagine, into our Q&A. But Andre Podradza, if I can stick with the sort of international NATO part of your remarks that you gave here, NATO in the world, your third topic. He says here, which NATO model are we heading towards? Given the strategic rivalry between the US and China, will NATO be more of a global alliance, or will collective defense against threats, example from Russia, continue to be central? We know certainly during the Trump administration, Secretary General, there's quite a bit of emphasis about turning towards the risks from China, which I think you did allude to in your remarks. But do you see, as he asked this question, is there going to be a new model where NATO becomes part of that US-China rivalry?
We don't regard China as an adversary, and there are opportunities connected to the rise of China. The strong economic growth has helped to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, and of course, the strong economic growth in China over decades have also been important for NATO allies, important for our export markets, our economies. Having said that, there are some challenges for our security. Soon, China will have the biggest economy in the world. China is an authoritarian society which does not share our values. We see that in the way they crack down on democracy, human rights activists in Hong Kong, how they deal with minorities or oppress minorities in their own country, like the Uyghurs, and also the way they have threatened Taiwan, or the way they actually behave, for instance, in the South China Sea. China is also now investing heavily in new modern military capabilities, including new nuclear capabilities. And China is present in NATO countries, investing heavily in infrastructure. We had an important discussion about 5G, and I think we've seen a convergence of views within NATO, realizing that, for instance, 5G network is crucial not only for our economies, but also for the resilience of our societies and fundamentally about the security of our societies. And NATO is a unique platform to bring together North America and Europe to address these challenges, because in security, size matters. Of course, NATO is important for Europe, but NATO is also important for America, and especially addressing the security consequences of the rise of China, it matters for the United States that they have 29 friends and allies in NATO. Let me just end by saying that, for me, this is not about making NATO a global alliance. NATO will remain an alliance with members from Europe and North America, and our collective security guarantees, they apply for North America and Europe. But the threats we face in this region, they are becoming more and more global. Terrorism, cyber, space, and the rise of China, these are global challenges that affect our regional security. Therefore, being a regional alliance, we need a global approach, and this is also what we address in NATO 2030.
Well, thank you for that important distinction. As you said, a North Atlantic alliance in terms of collective security guarantees, but an alliance that has global interests. There are a number of questions. I'm sort of going to grouping them together. But Gigi Alsebrook in particular, along with others, asking about the dilemma I'm sure you're having to deal with two key members, Greece and Turkey, facing quite a serious set of disputes and disagreements, including deployment of vessels and so on in the Eastern Mediterranean. How are you as the Secretary General managing this challenge? And how do you see the way forward, to put it bluntly, given both countries' central role for a strong NATO in the future?
It is well known, and it's actually part of what we have also addressed in NATO at several occasions, that there are differences between NATO allies, and in this case between two important NATO allies, Greece and Turkey. Both Greece and Turkey are valued allies, but they disagree on some issues, including related to the Eastern Mediterranean. I think that NATO's role is to provide a platform to address these differences. When we disagree, when there are differences, we need to convene and to sit down and to have open and honest discussions about the differences. And that's exactly what we have done when it comes to, for instance, the situation in the Eastern Mediterranean. And therefore, we have been able to establish at NATO what we call a deconfliction mechanism, and that's actually a military lines of communications, a hotline, military technical talks between the Greek and the Turkish military and personnel here at NATO in Brussels, and by that reducing the risks of incidents, accidents between ships, planes in the Eastern Med coming from Turkey and Greece. This is important because in the 1990s, where we had similar differences, tensions between Greece and Turkey, we actually saw that that led to casualties, to serious incidents that led to actually fatalities and loss of personnel. We need to prevent that from happening again, and that's the reason why we have established this deconfliction mechanism at NATO. This has also helped to pave the way for Greece and Turkey to sit down and restart what they call exploratory talks on the underlying disagreements. So yes, there are concerns, but I think the most important thing NATO can do is to try to find ways to step by step, not only complain about the concerns and express concerns, but also find a positive approach, a way forward. And over the last weeks and months, we have seen some important steps in the right direction, proving that NATO has an important role to play also when allies disagree, as they do, for instance, in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Thank you. We have quite a few questions coming in on the cyber question as well. I'm just looking here. Obviously, you highlighted this as, I think, your fifth or one of your key topics in your list for the young group to focus on. And I can see John Paul Rosario has asked a question about whether NATO, having created its cyberspace operations center in Belgium, there's the big discussion about broadening the Article 5 commitment to include significant cyber attacks. And he asks, what do you consider a significant cyber attack? I think there are a couple other questions about cybersecurity, but let's focus on that one first, if we could. How are you going to be able to keep that predictability, the deterrent effect of NATO alive in this cyber era in particular?
So we will never give a potential adversary or enemy the privilege of telling them exactly when we're going to trigger Article 5. That's for us to decide based on a concrete assessment of a concrete situation. But what we have clearly stated is that a cyber attack might trigger Article 5. So if we assess it, deem it as serious enough, then we can trigger Article 5, meaning that then we have all NATO allies stepping up and protecting the ally or those allies that are under a cyber attack. We can respond in cyber, but we can also respond in other domains. That's up to us to decide. The whole purpose of deterrence is to prevent an attack. And the success of NATO has been that we have been able to prevent conflict. The purpose of NATO is not to fight the war. The purpose of NATO is to prevent the war. And we have done so successfully for decades. Then I think we have to recognize that in cyber, the line between peace and war is more blurred. And that's one of the challenges we face, that before it was easy to define whether we were at war or whether it was living in peace. Now that with terrorism, cyber, hybrid threats, that line is more blurred, and that in itself is a challenge. We have established cyber as an operational domain, and we have also developed what we call national cyber effects, sometimes also referred to as offensive cyber. And NATO allies use that in a very effective way, for instance, in combating Daesh, ISIS in Iraq and Syria. We were able to take down many of their cyber capabilities that were important for them, recruiting, spreading their propaganda, financing. So offensive cyber or national cyber effects are also part of what NATO has developed over the last years, and we continue to strengthen our cyber defenses.
Thank you. We've got another 4 minutes between the two of us, Secretary General, just so you know where we are in the flow. And thank you, everyone, for all the questions. I don't know how many more we'll be able to take, but I've got a few left here. I want to make sure we touch on maybe a little bit traditional, but Anastasia asks the very obvious question. What mechanisms do you foresee NATO developing in its 2030 agenda to contain continued Russian aggression? Full stop.
Credible deterrence, and that's exactly what we have done for more than 70 years, and we will continue to do so. And we have done that over the last years also by significantly strengthening our collective defense, the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War, with the deployment of combat-ready battle groups to the eastern part of the lines in the Baltic countries and Poland, with increased readiness of our forces, with a new command structure, and, of course, with the fact that all NATO allies, after cutting defense spending for many years, all NATO allies have, since 2014, increased defense spending. So the adaptation of NATO, the fact that we are modernizing our military capabilities, that's the best way to make sure that no ally is is suffering any attack from any direction, including, of course, also from Russia.
Two more questions. Paul Newman asks, again, a very big and important question. How do you see the arrival of the Biden administration affecting the future of NATO and the kind of plans that you're developing? Do you see some fundamental change?
I welcome the new Biden administration. I'm looking forward to working with President Biden and his security team. I have spoken with President Biden twice since elections, and he has expressed strongly his personal commitment to NATO. I have worked with him in his previous capacities, and I know that President Biden is a strong personal supporter of the transatlantic bond, and he knows NATO very well. I also spoken with Secretary Blinken and Secretary the new Defense Secretary and Austin, and they also express their strong personal commitment. So I think that the new Biden administration provides a unique opportunity to re-energize, to revitalize, to rebuild NATO, and I look forward to welcoming President Biden to the NATO summit here in Brussels later this year.
And maybe one last question, I think, if this is what we've got time for now. Daphne Yalug has asked a question about environmental threats. In fact, there's a couple of questions about environmental issues here. For environmental threats, is NATO going to have to rethink its value structure and its habits and its customs? And can NATO play a role in that redefinition of what security is? Tanji Morgan asks a similar question. Climate change is not just a climate threat, it is driven and is affecting biodiversity in particular, and that also has security implications. So how inventive can NATO be in rethinking these environmental dimensions of future security? How much of a role can NATO play in that space?
So climate change is a serious issue for many reasons. One of them is that climate change affects our security. Climate change is a crisis multiplier, and therefore it matters for NATO, and therefore NATO has to address the security consequences of climate change. One of the reasons I want to, as part of NATO 2030, to launch a process where NATO is adapting, developing a new strategic concept is that actually in the existing strategic concept we agreed back in 2010, climate change is hardly mentioned. It's mentioned one word, tiny reference to climate change. I think that in the new strategic concept for NATO, which we hopefully then will start to develop when we meet at the NATO leaders meeting later this year, climate change has to play a much more prominent and important role. NATO should do its part, partly to look into how we can reduce emissions from military operations. We know that heavy battle tanks or fighter jets and naval ships, they consume a lot of fossil fuel and emit greenhouse or CO2, greenhouse gases, CO2. And therefore, we have to look into how we can reduce those emissions by alternative fuels, solar panels, other ways of running our emissions. That will be good for the climate, reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases, but it will also increase the resilience of our troops and military operations, because we know that one of the vulnerabilities in any military operation is the supply of fossil fuels. Long supply lines, vulnerable supply lines, has always, through decades, been a critical vulnerability for many different military operations. So if we can make us less dependent on that, we are both reducing emissions, but at the same time increasing the military effectiveness, the resilience of our troops. So we are working on that with different projects, to look into how we can make our militaries greener and less dependent on fossil fuels. So we will address climate change. We are in the process of stepping up in that area. And for me, it is a privilege to have my background as UN envoy on climate change and then bring that that background into my current responsibility as Secretary General of NATO.
Thank you very much for those answers. And actually, in particular, the one you made at the end there about actually potentially being more resilient as an alliance by actually addressing the climate challenge, because otherwise we're going to be facing enemies who may be ignoring these issues. Look, we're going to move now to engage the voices of the NATO young leaders. First, let's get a quick video up so we can introduce the whole process that you launched, Secretary General, as part of your NATO 2030 vision. Please, let's run the video and then we'll engage in conversation. Video first.
I would like to hear your views, to have your ideas, your proposals of how NATO can remain strong.
Alice Pilangalon, French.
My name is Don Cedar and I have a Dutch nationality.
My name is Martin Dimitrov. I come from Bulgaria.
My name is Corey Flesser. I am from the United States.
My name is Andrea Rafael-Rodriguez.
I'm from Spain. I'm Amri Mafedon and I'm British.
Hi, my name is Güde Jensen, and I am from Kiel, Northern Germany.
My name is Katrina Kurtisova, and I'm from Slovakia.
My name is Tanya Lacic, and I'm a Romanian living in Belgium.
My name is Jan Lukacevic. I'm a European coming from Czech Republic.
My name is Claudia Manejan, and I'm from Italy.
My name is Marc Steinberg. I'm Latvian.
Hi, guys. My name is Ulrich. I'm a Danish national living in Copenhagen.
My name is Ken Long, and I'm a proud 31-year-old Canadian.
I assume we have introduced all of the NATO young leaders there, in which case I'm going to come back in and engage now in the next part of our conversation. And I noticed that the NATO Secretary General was wearing a tie during that that little video, but he has definitely got in with the space of our NATO young leaders now in this part of the conversation. So what I'm going to do is introduce, first of all, Alice Billon-Gallon, who conveniently, from my point of view, is a research associate at Chatham House in our Europe program. She is one of the 14 NATO 2030 young leaders, as you saw introduced just there. In her case, she was nominated by the European Leadership Network. And Alice is going to kick off and at least kick off this process and introduce the first of our six speakers who will be engaging in conversation. Alice, over to you.
Thank you, Robin. And on behalf of the group, thanks to you, Secretary General, for asking us to fit into your thinking for NATO 2030. I think it's fair to say that faced with the multiple and complex challenges which you just outlined in your speech, defending the 1 billion citizens who live in NATO countries is a moving target. This is why we believe that NATO will need to deter, defend, and provide security differently by 2030. Of course, NATO should firmly guard its strength with an enduring focus on deterrence and keeping the alliance militarily strong, as well as a renewed commitment to allied solidarity and democratic principles. But to meet all the new challenges, NATO will also need to embrace the change by combining a more holistic understanding of security with a more balanced transatlantic core and a truly global mindset. As you'll see, our report is made of both moonshot ideas and specific recommendations. The report doesn't aim to be a comprehensive strategy. Instead, we decided to focus on a couple of key issues which we believe should feature more prominently in NATO's work because they matter to the new security environment. So while being cautious to neither overextend NATO's mandate nor to over-securitize new policy areas, we argue that the alliance can bring considerable added value by doing three things. First, by providing a space for political consultations among allies and with like-minded partners on issues ranging from economic coercion to cyber attribution. Second, by providing leadership on global issues such as climate security and space governance. And finally, by fostering a new mindset on crucial topics such as resilience or emerging technologies. My colleagues will now present to you some of our key recommendations. Let me first introduce Tanya Letzic, nominated by CIPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Addis, Secretary General. For us, resilience lies really at the heart of NATO's ability to defend and to deter in 2030. So let me share with you two key recommendations. First, we think NATO should become a resilience pathfinder. What does that mean? Well, it means that NATO has a greater role to play in helping allies achieve resilience across the board. Now, resilience is a moving target, but we bring concrete ideas like a resilience barometer or a civil military strategy that can help NATO craft a security insurance policy for the crises of the 2030s. Now, for us, resilience is split across 8 key domains. They range from the internal to the economic and from the defense to outer space. Now, second, we recommend a reform of the 2% defense spending target. We believe that what counts as a defense contribution in 2030 should be reimagined. We believe there's no better way to incentivize allies to spend on areas such as climate security, anti-hybrid warfare, or economic resilience than making it count as a contribution to our common defense. We believe that as NATO becomes a resilience pathfinder, it should also find the path towards responsibility rather than burden sharing. So any new metric should be inclusive of diverse contributions that strengthen our collective defense and our collective resilience. Thank you.
Secretary General, you heard those remarks from Tanya and also from Alice. Do you have a question back in return to them or a comment you'd like to make? Over to you, sir.
Yes, first of all, I would like to thank Alice for the report you and your group have written, because that's a very concise and concrete report, and you can be extremely proud of that input. And this is really an important input for me. As I prepare my recommendations, my proposals for the heads of state and government when they meet, and then for them to make final decisions on how NATO can adapt, change, so we are as successful in the future as we have been since our foundation more than 70 years ago. So many, many thanks. Then to Tanya, I will say that resilience has been, I think, underestimated for many, many years, because the focus has been on military strength. And of course, military strength is important. We need modern military capabilities. But unless we have strong societies, we will not be able to have strong defense forces. And therefore, everything related to resilience has become much more important for NATO allies. And I like the idea you have about NATO as a resilience pathfinder, and how we need to constantly develop, is a moving target, develop the aims and the goals and the guidelines we set for resilience. Resilience that's about infrastructure, but also about economic considerations and economic resilience. And my question is actually about what do you think NATO should do when it comes to allied economic resilience, in addition to what national governments and other international organizations are doing in that area?
Tanya, that's a question back to you.
Yes, thank you, Secretary General, for this question. This is really one of the absolute key aspects that we have to figure out by 2030. The first commandment of resilience is that you're as strong as your weakest link. Now, today, in our hyper-globalized economy, weaponized economic power can be as damaging as traditional military power. For example, if we think of supply chains that feed into both civil and military technology, if these are disrupted, this is not going to only cause commercial losses, but can actually compromise NATO's defense posture. So these are risks that unfold at the nexus between security, economy, and technology. And we need to better understand them and address them in a holistic manner if we want to aim for economic resilience. Now, for this, our group recommends equipping NATO with geo-economic tools. Now, the first step is to put geoeconomics and economic resilience firmly back on the agenda of NATO by resurrecting the economic committee. Now, this committee can help bring the right expertise within NATO and can help it coordinate with other geoeconomic relevant organizations such as the European Union. The second step would be taking interoperability, which is the concept at the core of how NATO functions, and extending it to economic resilience. By doing this, NATO could become a hub where allies could coordinate on export control regimes or on setting up robust yet aligned foreign investment screening mechanisms. What is clear is that economic coercion is a threat that NATO cannot ignore. The key does lie in allied hands, but NATO can help them, can help point them at the right door. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, Tanya. I notice I will do some Robin Niblett editorializing. I also found your second recommendation on rethinking the 2% target a very interesting provocation, which I'm sure the Secretary General and all of NATO will be considering very carefully. I think the focus right now on resilience obviously has been essential. We have two more blocks of recommendations and interaction with the Secretary General. Keeping an eye on time, we're only running about 3 minutes behind, but just to remind you, the time is very tight. I'm going to give the floor now to two more of the seven members of the NATO team, young leaders team, who are presenting here. This is to Ulrik Smed, who is with the Office of the Tech Ambassador of the Danish Foreign Ministry, who's been nominated by the Atlantic Council, and Katarina Ketisova, who is actually a fellow with the European Leadership Network and has been nominated by Globsec. So, Ulrik, do you want to start off first and then to Katarina with your set of recommendations?
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Secretary General, for allowing us to be here today. I'd like to highlight some of our group's thinking on values and why this is important for NATO, especially following the events in recent years and months. So at home, we believe allies should recommit to NATO's democratic values at the upcoming summit this year, to the rule of law, transparency, and division of powers. And operationally, we recommend leaders to have an annual discussion on democratic principles and work towards a written values pledge that would outline norms and responsibilities that allies strive to live by, to focus NATO's purpose and its commitments in the years to come. Because we need to be ready and credible in the eyes of citizens and for an era of geopolitical competition on values. Abroad, we think the alliance should become a beacon for democracy, to work together with democracies around the world. NATO's partnership should be anchored in value-based principles on all levels, political, capacity building, and operational engagements. A decade ago, we might have taken for granted that our values and the direction of travel, but we can't afford to do that any longer. We need to lean in. And that's why NATO needs a global partnership for peace with an open horizon to the world and an active approach to partnerships with democratic nations, also outside the North Atlantic region. So in 2030, we would like to see NATO lead by example at home and abroad in a transparent and accountable way while building the democratic foundations for an era of global competition on values. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ulrik. And let me just say, there was a very, I thought, important question we did not get to in the discussion earlier from Rachel Smith, who talked about precisely what you raised, the issue of values and whether the alliance can remain as committed and how it could do it. So thank you very much for those comments, Ulrik. Incredibly important. Katarina, you've got the very big issue now of climate. Over to you.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Secretary General. As we speak, climate change is affecting our security environment. NATO can and should do more to climate-proof its policies and operations. I'd like to offer three recommendations from our climate chapter. First, we believe that NATO should capitalize on the current political momentum and put climate change at the top of the political agenda, starting with the next NATO summit. On that occasions, the ally should publicly state that climate change is an existential threat and a fundamental security risk to the alliance. At the North Atlantic Council, an informal caucus of allies that are already actively engaged in addressing climate security risks could be established to facilitate the exchange of lessons learned and best practices and to regularly brief the NAC. And ultimately, to echo what the Secretary General has already stated, climate change should be embedded in an updated strategic concept. Second, NATO needs to better understand the conflict and instability implications of climate change. Partnerships at all levels, military cooperation programs, and diplomatic tools are very important for NATO to understand the underlying dynamics on the ground and to be prepared to respond in time. A combination of remote sensing, big data, and AI, while improving intelligence sharing among allies, would increase NATO's capacity to better forecast future environmental shocks. And lastly, NATO should lead by example and act as a catalyzer for climate action by supporting allies in their emissions reduction and adaptation efforts. Thank you.
Secretary General, some questions or comments back to Ulrich and Katharina.
So first to Ulrich, I very much agree that values is what NATO is actually founded on. So we need to stand up for those values. And NATO has, of course, partly been important in defending those values by defending those values against authoritarian threats and challenges from the outside, especially during the Cold War with the Soviet Union. Then after the end of the Cold War, NATO played a key role in spreading those values through the enlargement. We have gone from 12 members to now 30 members, and just by that, we have helped to spread democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty throughout Europe. But then thirdly, we need to be honest and also talk about the concerns that some allies express about our own ability to live up to our own values. And there, I think that the most important thing NATO can do is that we are open, we are frank, we provide a platform also for allies to express their concerns and to look into how we can make sure that we defend and protect the values also internally. I refer to the attack on the U.S. Capitol or the U.S. Congress building as one example of how we can never take these values for granted, even inside our own countries. This is not the first time we see concerns expressed about values in our own countries, but I think that NATO's role is to address these concerns in an open and frank way, and I'm absolutely certain that will be also part of the NATO 2030 agenda. Then on climate change, I also already said some words about climate change. But again, I really hope, and I not only hope, but I know that climate change will be on the top of the NATO agenda. It will be an important issue when leaders meet and also as we start to develop a new strategic concept. But climate change is so important that it's not enough only to talk and write about it. We need to do something concrete to reduce emissions. And therefore, I also welcome your third element, that we need to actually help allies to reduce their own military emissions. And therefore, my question is that do you think that NATO allies should set voluntary targets for reducing their emissions from military activities, military emissions? And what more could we do to help to reduce emissions from military?
Katharina, I think that's for you.
Thank you for that question. I would say that before we speak about voluntary targets, the first step would be to help allies measure their military emissions. And once those are known and maybe made public, in the next step, NATO could help allies set voluntary targets so they can reduce their emissions in ways that do not compromise operational effectiveness. But there's more that NATO can do. Another step would be to set green targets for defense planning, and such targets could include a 25% fuel efficiency increase, higher standards for military facilities, or cleaner equipment and support solutions. And to revert back to our recommendation about a reformed 2% defense spending metric, we believe that the development of sustainable technologies, of green technology, should form part of that reformed metric.
Thank you very much for that reply, Katrina, and for keeping this conversation going. And we are moving again pretty well on time here, Secretary General. What we're going to do now is come to the last third block, and we're going to get some opening remarks from Corey Flesser, Women, Peace, Security Advisor at Booz Allen Hamilton, nominated by the German Marshall Fund of the US, the GMF. We're going to hear from Jan Lukacevic, Research Assistant at the Czech Academy of Sciences, who was nominated by the Aspen Institute Europe. And we'll be hearing from Andrea Garcia Rodriguez, who is a research fellow at the Barcelona Center for National Affairs, CIDOB, nominated by CyberSec. Corey, can you kick off this section first, please, with your comments about partnerships and cooperation? Over to you.
Thank you, Robin. Secretary General, I'll highlight two recommendations on partnerships. Our first recommendation aims to enhance cooperation between NATO and the European Union. The group acknowledges a deeper NATO-EU partnership would further cement the existing bonds within the Euro-Atlantic community and benefit both common members as well as single membership nations of both organizations. To streamline and elevate cooperation, the group recommends appointing a NATO special representative for NATO-EU relations. This special representative would be responsible for strengthening existing recognized areas of cooperation, as well as identifying new or underexplored areas. This could include emerging technologies, space governance, and climate security. Our second recommendation focuses on allied cohesion, unity, and coherence in NATO's engagement with partners in the Indo-Pacific. Our report highlights the increasing geopolitical importance of the Indo-Pacific region and the need to enhance allies' collective understanding of China's regional activities and global influence. The group recommends establishing an alliance-wide approach to Indo-Pacific partnerships with a focus on political and practical cooperation with like-minded nations and multilateral organizations. NATO should engage in structured political consultations with key Indo-Pacific partners on topics that reflect shared areas of interest, such as economic security, freedom of navigation, and resilience. Such strategic engagement would help the alliance achieve a more uniform understanding of the challenges posed by China and expand NATO's global network of democratic values-based partnerships. Thank you.
Thank you, Corey. Let me turn straight now to Jan Lukacevic for his comments on emerging and disruptive technologies. Jan.
Thank you. Dear Secretary General, to keep the technological edge, NATO needs to change its mindset. In a rapidly evolving environment of emerging technologies, such as space technologies or biotech, NATO needs to take a proactive approach in their development and adoption. I'd like to highlight three recommendations here. Our first recommendation is to NATO to go digital. NATO should put more effort to fully digitize Euro-Atlantic political and military institutions. Efficient gathering and processing information from allied countries can greatly enhance the speed of our decision-making. Digitization enables the use of AI, machine learning, and quantum capabilities. These are also in a focal point of NATO innovation. Second, NATO should strive to identify new technologies early on, strive to accelerate their development and adopt them across the whole alliance. We propose the creation of a new agency focusing on emerging and disruptive technologies. We call it NATO Strive. In short, this ecosystem will encompass the early identification of emerging technologies and their further research and development. This will result in accelerated adoption and bridging the gap between the private sector, academia, and leadership of NATO allies. Our third recommendation suggests NATO being an ethical norm setter. A newly established ethical framework would enable NATO to set norms in the area of emerging technologies, allowing alliance to protect and uphold its values in future. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jan. Let me turn first to you, Secretary General, to respond to those comments, any questions you might have back to the group, and we'll get Andrea to reply. Over to you, Secretary General.
So first to Corey, I totally agree that partnerships are important for NATO. No single institution, no single country can manage all the security challenges we face alone. So we need to work together. Therefore, for instance, for NATO, it has been extremely important to strengthen the cooperation with the European Union. And I'm glad to see that we have been able to lift the cooperation between NATO and the European Union to unprecedented levels. I meet regularly with the EU leadership, and we are constantly in dialogue with them about how we can further strengthen. Just the fact that more than 90% of the people in the EU live in a NATO country illustrates the importance of us working closely together. I also agree with you on the importance of trying to look into how we can further strengthen cooperation partnership with our partners in the Indo-Pacific region. We have four partners there already in South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. And I think also when we look at that, at those partners, we see that these are countries which are also important when it comes to standing up for our democratic values. And they are eager to work more closely with NATO. We are eager to work more closely with them. And in the light of the rise of China, I think that the partnership in the Indo-Pacific region becomes even more important. And we need to also discuss, based on your recommendations, how we can further strengthen cooperation with like-minded democracies around the world. Then technology. I think it's hard in a way to understand how much new, disruptive, emerging technologies are changing the nature of warfare. I have read some books about the First World War, and people didn't realize the horrendous, the brutality of that war, because they hadn't really taken into account the consequences of the Industrial Revolution for war fighting. In one way, I think we risk doing the same mistake now, that artificial intelligence, facial recognition, autonomous weapon systems, quantum computing, all of that combined, it's not only changing our civilian societies, but it's also fundamentally changing the way conflicts will be fought in the future. And therefore, NATO needs, of course, to keep maintain the technological edge. But we also need to look into how can we develop arms control addressing new technologies. Arms control has traditionally been about counting warheads. Now it's about having regulations of cyber, of algorithms, of a lot of other areas where the normal counting of warheads doesn't work. So how do we apply arms control to disruptive emerging technologies? That's a big chapter. And also when it comes to ethical dimensions, and there I think also NATO should be, as you also allude to, a standard setter. And this is uncharted waters, and we should really have an open mind on how NATO can play a constructive role in addressing all these challenges related to technology. I have one question. Is that now, or should I wait?
You've got one more question coming to you from, or one more comment maybe in reply from Andrea. Andrea, over to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Secretary General, for your comments. I agree with you, and the group agrees that certainly emerging and disruptive technologies is a very big topic, and the issue of partnerships is another big topic. And I would like to highlight two issues that you've mentioned in your comments. The first one is about arms control, and the second one is about ethics. We believe that by the creation of this new entity called NATO Strive, we could work towards these two issues. First of all, because if NATO guides globally the development of emerging and disruptive technologies, it can also guide the way they are developed. For that reason, we believe that the creation of an ethical framework that should guide this development of these new technologies should be a priority for the Alliance. because not only through this NATO Strife Agency, NATO would be able to maintain its technological edge by seeking out and finding these technologies, as well as the companies and the startups and the ecosystem itself that have the potential to develop them, but also by exporting these ideas of these like ethical EDT, ethical emerging disruptive technologies to the world, and therefore reaffirming its power as an ethical norm setter and also as a democratic giant.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Secretary General, that brings us to the end of this section. I don't know if you wanted to make any last comment right now, otherwise I'm going to thank you and introduce the hackathon. But anything, any last comment from you, sir?
I have one comment on this issue of this new entity you have proposed, or both Andrea and Jan mentioned that we need a new entity to deal with disruptive and emerging technologies. I think that's an interesting idea. It's not for me now to conclude. I will consult with allies, with capitals, with leaders before I put forward my proposals for them. But I think that's an interesting idea, because I think that we need to relook into how NATO can deliver when it comes to bringing allies together in addressing the importance of new disruptive emerging technologies. One challenge we have is that traditionally new technologies were very much developed by the military. Also, everything from nuclear to the internet to GPS has been developed by government actors and often the military. Now very much of the technology is developed in the private sector. And of course, if we develop or establish a NATO entity for addressing emerging and disruptive technologies, then we also need to look into how can we link that entity with the private sector, including with startups. So that, if there's time, that's my last question, is actually the link between a NATO entity on technology and the crucial cooperation link with the private sector, including startups, which we know are so important for new technologies.
Thank you, Secretary General. I'm glad you brought that point in right at the end, because actually that was another of the questions we were unable to get to, which was the connection with the private sector in one of the earlier points. So I'm glad you had an opportunity to plug it at the end. Let me say right now, having moderated quite a few meetings in my time as director of Chatham House, I thought that was one of the most content-rich, concentrated dialogues I've had the privilege of moderating and witnessing. Huge thanks to our young NATO 2030 young leaders who showed many of us who are less young how to be able to really put good ideas over in a thoughtful and organized way. Thank you, Secretary General, for making the time, for inspiring and driving this process, and all of your teams as well back in at NATO. It really, I think, has been an incredibly productive moment. Now, this is not the end. I want to remind everyone, I said at the beginning, we're now going to be going into the policy hackathon. It will be starting at 15:15, I'll put it that way, depending on where you are. It is 6:15 right now, but at 15:15, we will be going into the hackathon. Those of you who've been watching this on live stream, stay with the same live stream. You will have an opportunity to continue engaging and offering questions through the Slido function that you've already done. Those of you who've been joining this session through Zoom, many of the Chatham House members and others who've been in through that platform, you've had in the chat line the link to follow to be able to now engage in the hackathon. It'll be, you need to follow the links that were provided there. And also there was a Slido link that you can use to be able to engage in the conversation as well. And this is gonna go on for 2 hours. So GMT from 16:15 to 18:15, at the end of which we should have some fascinating insights voted on with a jury, which are the best ideas, as you always get with a hackathon, on how NATO will adapt for all the big questions that we discussed today, the values battle, the economic as well as security resilience, the climate challenge, the technology disruption challenge, the interoperability, and where NATO sits in the world. Again, let me just thank you, Secretary General, for taking on so many of these ideas and engaging with these young NATO leaders. And again, I think on my behalf and everyone's here, great job to the 14 young leaders putting together these great ideas in such a concentrated way. So that's it from me. Look forward to seeing you in the hackathon. Go straight there, but it'll kick off at 15:15. Have a good, productive rest of your day. Thank you very much. Bye, Jens.
Thank you so much, Robin. Thank you.